It is a pleasure to welcome to this conversation Arie Breech. Arie has spent more than 30 years contributing to global innovations in diverse industries in a variety of executive roles, including general manager and CEO, as well as board of director and advisory roles. He has participated in different aspects of the development of hundreds of new products, learning from successes and mistakes. Arie currently serves his global clients as a groundbreaker in growth strategies, commercialization of new paradigms, change leadership, and turnaround. We are here to talk about Arie's book, Lay an Egg and Make Chicken Soup: The Holistic Innovation Process from Concept to Market Expansion. And perhaps we could start, Arie, if you tell us what inspired you to write this book.
Hey, John, hello. Thank you for having me. The book is kind of a process that I went throughout my career. The first job I had after school was designing a 32-bit microprocessor for the PC market, which at the time did not exist. And we designed it, we were about 3 to 5 years ahead of competition. However, the product didn't do very well because the company did not put enough resources on the post-R&D work. And it turns out that Intel and Motorola, or two other competitors, kind of bypassed us and became the leaders in that market, even though the product architecture was inferior, but they executed much better on the post-R&D stages in the process. So that's lesson number one. Fast forward on the past few years, I started to mentor lots of young entrepreneurs. And what I realized is that in most cases, these young people have great ideas, but in most cases, they don't have any clue or the experience on how to execute to bring this new idea into commercial success. So they are very good in A to B to C, but not so good in the D to Z part of the equation. And that's very important to bring the product or bring this new idea to the successful finish line. I started to blog and write papers based on experience of mentoring all these young entrepreneurs. And after a while, I realized I have enough material to put it together into a book. So that's what I did to answer the question. It's kind of an experience, both my career experience in dealing with the hundreds of new products, as well as mentoring, I would say, dozens, if not hundreds, of young entrepreneurs in the recent years.
Well, that's wonderful. How would you summarize the core message of the book?
I think Warren Buffett said it very well. If I may quote Warren Buffett, he said, "An idiot with a plan will outperform a genius without a plan." So that's kind of the theme of the book. In other words, the devil is in the details. You can have a great idea, but if you don't execute on the details later on, this great idea will never succeed.
And tell us about how you structured the book, and how you develop your key messages throughout the book.
So the structure of the book is almost like a checklist. The book has a chapter for each topic or each discipline that you must execute on, whether it's obviously the innovation process to start with, fundraising to fund your new idea, going into marketing, business development, or I prefer to call it ecosystem development. Sales, for example, sales of new product is different than sales of mature products. Normally, a mature product is just do a commission and the salesperson collects a purchase order every month with very little effort. A new product, it requires a totally different compensation method for salespeople because the sales effort is so longer. Intellectual property, manufacturing, logistics, customer support, each one of these success attributes has a chapter in the book. So if you look on the outline of the book, it can save as a checklist. And by the way, the checklist is available for free download from my website. But then when you deeper in the book, each chapter starts with introducing the topic, maybe one or two or three pages introducing the topic, and then a few real-life examples of successes or failures or lesson learned to demonstrate the topic. The other thing about structure of the book, I made an effort to be very diverse from an industry point of view, because what I've seen over my career is you can learn from one industry to another. Most people spend most of their career in one industry, so when they face a difficult challenge, sometimes they panic because they don't know how to solve it. However, if they look left or right, some other industries may have similar challenges, 5, 10, 15 years ago, and you can see how they approached it and learn from their successes or mistakes. So I made an effort to bring examples from different industries. I think there is like 20 or 30 different industries represented in the book. The other diversity dimension is different countries. Again, you can learn from how different cultures or different countries approach this or that example or challenge or opportunity. And the third dimension is along a time, because in many cases you don't see if a strategy worked or failed until many years later. You know, you can celebrate a success 3 years later, but long term, 20 years after that, it turns out to be not such a good strategy, or vice versa. So I try to take older examples, and the oldest one I used is the Gutenberg printing machine, and parallel that with the internet. In the recent years, the Gutenberg printing machine did to society, 500 years ago, what the internet is doing to us today. And many examples are 20, 30, 50 years old, so you can see the outcome at a long-term perspective. So this is the structure: diversity in industries, diversity in geographics, and diversity in time.
How would you describe what you call in the book the innovative mindset?
So that's a difficult thing to kind of explain or to summarize. From 100,000 feet view, innovation mindset is the mindset of challenging the status quo. You know, people look around themselves, and whether it's a business or even social or whatever it is, but the spirit of challenging what you see in the status quo is what makes a person innovative. If you look at, for example, Martin Luther King was a social innovator. Jesus was a religious innovator. Michael Dell, for example, did not invent a new computer. He invented a different way to sell computer and a different way to manage a supply chain of building computers. Another good example is Domino's Pizza. They did not invent a new way to make pizzas. They basically, their innovation is to better serve the pizza lovers or the pizza eaters or people that are consuming pizzas. Another element in the book or in society, for example, if you look on the U.S. society, U.S. is probably one of the, as a country, more innovative or more entrepreneurial than others, and I think it's kind of in the background or almost, so to speak, the DNA of the people, because as an immigration country, it takes innovative mindset or entrepreneurial mindset for a person to leave his or her life behind and move to another country, especially, you know, 200 or 300 years ago, you did this journey in a boat, with a boat, and you didn't have a telephone or a video phone to talk to your relatives that you left behind. So it was a major life-changing decision for these people, and you need a certain kind of character to do that. So in summary, the innovative mindset is the ability to take, to look at the status quo, challenge it, and also take an action to fix something you don't like in the status quo.
Well, that's a great way to describe it, I think. What are some good ways and perhaps some not so good ways of generating new ideas?
So innovation is almost like art. It's difficult. You never know when the apple will fall. Right, you cannot tell your chief technology officer, okay, on Tuesday between 10 and 11, you must invent something. It doesn't work that way because you never know when the apple will fall. In my case, for example, my best ideas come out at 4 a.m. in the morning when I take my morning walk or in the shower. But for other people, it may be in a different way. So this is one, I would say, caution to, it's difficult to structure, although there are some attempts to structure innovation process, but it's very difficult to structure. The other thing is agree on what you're trying to solve, because let's say you say, okay, XYZ is a problem, we need to solve it. Somebody else may say XYZ, it's not a problem at all, so why try to solve it? And if you try to solve it for me, I'm not going to pay you for that because I don't think it's a problem, therefore I'm not going to pay you for that. So the first step is to agree on the problem, and the second step is to agree on the solution strategy. If you go back to the 1960s, President Kennedy had a huge problem in his head, in his hands, and the problem was the Soviet Union was ahead of the U.S. in space exploration, and Kennedy saw that as a strategic threat to the U.S. Some people may argue that this was not a strategic threat, so he thought it was a strategic threat, and the other again discussion is how to deal with this strategic threat. He came up with a solution to put a man on the moon, and with very aggressive timeline. Somebody else may come up with a different solution to this strategic threat. So this is an example of how to agree or disagree on what the problem we're solving, and then once you agree on the problem, how to solve it. Another element that is kind of recently evolved in different studies is the phenomena of having diverse teams. It turns out in the 1980s that diversity became a popular thing to do in the corporate world as the right thing to do for social justice. Now that we are 20, 30 years later, there are lots of studies done that shows that diverse teams performed about 50 to 70% better than homogeneous teams. So add this to the innovative formula or recipe, so to speak.
Very interesting. Switching gears a little bit to another topic in your book, learning curve management. What do you really mean by that?
Excellent question. Anytime you do something the first time or the first few times, it takes longer and it's not very successful. The simple example is if you have to change the first time you change a tire in your vehicle, it took me at least an hour if I remember well. But if you look at the professional tire shops, they change a tire in minutes. And if you watch race cars, for example, they have the system perfected so well that it takes them seconds to change a tire. So that this phenomena is called learning curve. It's the same in business or in anytime you innovate, basically by definition, you do something new you haven't done before. Therefore, the cost of this new product or new service is higher. You make more mistakes along the way because it's kind of something new you're doing. After you introduce the product, it may come back with lots of customers' questions because if a product is so new, the people don't know how to use it very well, so they call you back and asking questions about how to use it. Some people buy it out of curiosity and then they try to return because they don't like it, so that adds to the cost. So all these things are adding to the cost of the first products in the market. And first could be the first 100 or the first 3,000 products, but those are more expensive. The other element that contribute to higher cost in the early shipments or early products is from your supply chain. Let's say you the long-term consumption of your product is, for the sake of this example, 10,000 units a month, but initially you don't sell on day one 10,000 units a month. You start with a few hundreds or a few thousands, and then your suppliers has a higher cost for these units because you buy them in lower volume. But the other side of the equation, you have to sell those low volume units at the market price that the market will buy it from. Otherwise, they will never buy if you don't price it correctly. So basically, you be prepared to lose money at the beginning and put together a plan on how to reduce the cost as soon as you can or accelerate as soon as you can to get to the long-term cost structure. For example, I was hired a couple of times to fix or accelerate a learning curve issue where the market price was $15 to $20 per product or per unit, but the cost to manufacture was over $100. So you lose money on every product that you ship. You lose a significant amount of money. And these were technology products, took over a year to fix this cost issue, but that's pretty normal in every new product. Maybe these two examples are extreme examples, but it's always more expensive to build at the beginning. So if you're working for a large company, if you go a little over budget, your boss will yell at you, or you get slapped on the hand. But if you are a small business or entrepreneur or a startup company, if you go over budget and you run out of cash, basically you run out of business. So it's very, very important, especially for a smaller business, to take into account this learning curve phenomena in your budget planning. Otherwise, you're going to basically go out of business before the product has a chance to prove itself.
Ari, in the book, you dedicate a whole chapter to emotional products. Could you please elaborate on that?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite subjects. Traditionally, emotional product is a product you buy for emotional purpose or to fulfill an emotional need. For example, if you buy jewelry to a loved one, that's pure emotional product. There is no function it gives you other than just expressing your love or satisfying your other partner. So this is very obvious. But for example, buying a vehicle so you can drive to work, that's a functional product. But if you buy the dream car to your loved one, that's a functional product with an emotional motivation to buy it. So I'll give you a few examples. For example, one of the best examples in recent years is cage-free eggs. It's becoming very popular, and those the price, last time I checked in the supermarket, is two or three times more expensive than cage eggs, and more and more people pay this high premium. It's an emotional decision just because they feel sorry for these chickens in the cage. So this is a very good example of just a pure functional product, eating an egg for breakfast, but you pay two or three times more to fulfill your emotional feeling sorry for these chickens. And by the way, cage-free eggs, I think a few years ago, at least in Europe, exceeded more than 50% of the eggs sold in Europe are cage-free now, and people pay this high premium just because they feel sorry for the chickens. So these are consumer products, B2C. If you switch gear, for example, and talk to B2B, that makes it a little more interesting and more complex or sophisticated. You expect the B2B buying decision to be pure professional, but in many cases it's not. For example, in the old days, IBM's selling slogan used to be, "You'll never be fired for buying IBM." And that played on people's emotional need for job security. Maybe a competitor X had a superior product on paper, but if X fails, your job is in jeopardy for making this risky buying decision. But if you bought an IBM at the time, nobody would fire you because you make a decision to buy an IBM. A few years ago, while I led a high-tech B2B product launch that had a unique out-of-the-box feature, we told our customers' engineers that this new feature will put them on the cutting edge of technology, and it must have line on their resume in their future job search. And if they don't, they become obsolete, professionally obsolete in a few years. And this emotional motivation of these engineers to be in the cutting edge of their profession basically motivated them to be early adopters of this product launch, and it was a very successful launch. Purely, well, the product was good, but the whole launch campaign was based on emotional motivation of the engineers that are buying this component just to enhance their career.
Very interesting. In chapter 11 of the book, you redefine business development as ecosystem development. Please explain that.
Yes, most companies relate to business development of a new product as recruiting early adopters. That's only part of the equation and could be okay if the new product is just an incremental evolution from a previous version or an evolutionary product. Evolutionary product like this, by most part, is kind of business as usual. There is not much innovation in it. But when you are launching a true innovative paradigm product, getting the first few people to try it is a small part of the roadmap to a long-term success. In these cases, business development is more about ecosystem recruiting and ecosystem preparation. Things like synergetic products that you must have in order to succeed. Without these other products, your product cannot succeed. Infrastructure readiness, support, recruit government support or government regulations, market education. If it's so new, people don't know about it, you have to educate the people what it does for them. All of these are parts of the ecosystem preparation. The new product success is highly dependent on maximizing the ecosystem support, and you want to create a win-win-win-win from all the ecosystem components, and that's almost like creating a tailwind, because if everybody wins from your success, you are more likely to succeed. For example, electrical vehicles. If you design an it's not enough to design an electrical vehicle, because you need to get the buy-in from thousands of utilities to create the right business model to charge how you pay for charging this electrical vehicle. You need to get a buy-in from the commercial landlords to install the charging stations in their facilities. You need to buy in from the governments to create regulation that will support this new concept of electrical vehicle. It's not so new anymore, but if you dial back 10 years ago, it was revolutionary. Without all these supporting components, you cannot succeed. This brings another important component, and that's cooperation with competitors. Your competitors are part of the ecosystem. When you launch a real innovative product, you must join forces with your competitors to do several things that all of you require to get the market acceptance. For example, deal with government regulation, lobby with governments to get the right regulation to support this product. It's not just your product, it's also the product category that includes your competitors. So you better off joining forces with your competitors to get the right government regulation, and after you get all this infrastructure and government regulation ready, then you start the competition. So even competitors are part of the ecosystem that you need to deal with at the beginning, at least.
Very interesting. Counterintuitive, but it makes a lot of sense.
Right. I was a CEO of a technology company several years ago. I used to have a lunch once a quarter with my counter CEOs of my competitors, just for that purpose that I just mentioned. We had to coordinate many things to make sure that the market is ready, and then later we compete. So it's kind of a friendly competition, but you have to work together to create the market and then start compete.
Correct. In chapter 6, the title caught my attention. It says, in business, different is often better than better. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, this Incremental evolutionary product are just business as usual. I had many startups coming, you know, trying to get my help, and they say, oh, we are 20-30% better than the competitors. But guess what? It will take them, by the time they launch their new product, the competitor will be 20-30% better as well. And so, you know, just being better, no matter how better you are, it's not sufficient. It's easier to compete when you completely change the rules of the game. So if you think about geometrical metaphor, if the status quo is competing on a plane of XY plane, you must find a way to create a Z-axis, a three-dimensional or a totally different attribute to create a new market. Example, I used to work for Motorola many years ago, and the competition back then on cellular phones was just between how many features I can put and what would be the battery lifetime with so many features. So you had a kind of a trade-off between features and battery life, and nobody paid attention to how the phone looks. All the phones were black, looked more or less the same. Nokia realized back in the mid to late 90s, they realized that the cell phone is becoming a popular accessory among young people. So they had a very simple addition to the equation. They introduced color options for their telephones. Very simple twist. Could be very easy to mimic even by the competitors, but most of the competitors actually belittled Nokia for treating this so-called serious technology industry like a child play, and they never even tried to compete with Nokia on this color option thing. So Nokia did very well at the late 90s just because they were the only ones to offer color options, and they succeeded extremely well in those days. Later on, they failed on other execution thing, but this short period of 1995 to 2000, Nokia kicked everybody's butt just by this simple twist that nobody paid attention to.
And Ari, just to make sure we address the core metaphor of the book, can you expand a little bit on that? What exactly you mean by laying an egg and making chicken soup?
Yeah, good question. So in many new product or innovation cases, you run into a chicken and an egg dilemma. You say, okay, I have this idea, but in order to test this idea, I need to spend, you know, $10,000 or $100,000 on market research. But then why should I spend the $10,000 on this new idea if I am not sure if this idea is a good idea? So this is a chicken and an egg dilemma that many new products face. So this is where the name of the book came from. I took it to the next level because the book is talking about expanding the business and scaling the business. So it's not just a chicken and egg, but the chicken becomes a chicken soup. So that's where the name coming from. The other part of the motivation for the name is the success of the innovation is like a recipe for a dish. So if you miss one component, the dish will not succeed. So you have to follow this recipe of, you know, 20 or 30 different steps you have to take in order to succeed and get a superb chicken soup.
Great. Well, Ari, this has been wonderful. Perhaps before we finish up, I would be very curious if you would share any interesting things that are capturing your imagination these days, anything you're willing to share about your focus these days?
Yes, so I kind of continue to do, when we started this conversation, I talked about the mentorship thing. So this is one thing I continue to do, mentor young entrepreneurs. And even more than young is a relative term. So basically mentor executives. The other thing that I spend my time is supporting this book, different talking opportunities about this book, like this one, Thanks for Having Me. Tomorrow or Thursday, I have another presentation to live audience, so that's a pretty time-consuming as well. The third component is just engaging, supporting different startups or different businesses at any given time. I have several clients where I help them either in business ecosystem development and fundraising. So I'm working on that as well at any given time with several clients.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be here today and share your wisdom with our members.
Thanks for having me, John.
The book is Lay an Egg and Make Chicken Soup. Thank you all for being part of this session. Goodbye for now.
Bye-bye.